everyone, and welcome to Tim Topham TV episode 2. I'm joined by the fabulous Christopher Norton live in Melbourne. Chris has just arrived off the plane from London. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Great pleasure.
After a very short amount of sleep. And today's podcast is all about improvising again, but this time a different take. Chris has got quite a different way of approaching improvising from Daniel, who we spoke to 2 weeks ago. And the title of this podcast is Using Improv to Create a Musician for Life, which I think is fantastic and something we should obviously all be aiming for. So, welcome, Chris. How come you're in Australia?
I've been asked to do various presentations, particularly for ANSCA, the Australia-New Zealand Examination Board, and I'm working in how many places? Six altogether, I think, three in New Zealand and three in Australia.
Right.
And so I'm just doing various teacher and student events across Australasia.
Okay, and what's the focus of those?
The focus is particularly the new syllabus. I don't know if it's a new syllabus, but the syllabus which ANSCA is promoting, which involves improvisation, is particularly using American Proctor Piano. And I'm here to talk to teachers about how easy it is to use and how to use it.
Sure. So that's American Popular Piano, which is a series that you brought out a few years ago.
Yes, it came out in 2007. And it's a slightly different approach to improvisation teaching in the sense that it involves just the grand staff. So until level six, there are no chord symbols and no scales or modes mentioned.
Right.
It's all done just by reading the grand staff.
And so I like this because Daniel in episode one was really talking about modes and using scales and rhythms and things like that. So just completely from scratch,
yeah.
Let's improvise. Whereas your method, which might appeal, or probably appeal to quite a lot of teachers who are very much based on reading and that kind of area, actually starts with reading music, doesn't it?
It does. Now, the gist of it is that you there's a whole series of pieces, and the books, each repertoire book has pieces in three categories. The first category is lyrical pieces. The second category is rhythmic pieces, which obviously like strict time. And the third are ensembles, so they're piano duets.
Okay.
And the ensembles have backing tracks as well. I mean, it all sounds rather sort of over complex perhaps, but it works out easily when you sort of look at it in detail. But the idea was that we wouldn't put backing tracks on everything.
Right.
So that that becomes an ensemble aspect. It's not just there for the sake of having a backing track, but it's there because you're thinking about the fact that it's a different type of ensemble.
Yeah.
Anyway, the student gets to choose a lyrical piece, a rhythmic piece, an ensemble piece, say, like a syllabus. And in fact, with some of the examination boards who've taken this on, that's what happens. It's like the old-fashioned notion of ABC, if you like, lyrical, rhythmic, and ensemble. And they learn their pieces, and then once they've learned the piece, they've got sort of harmonic and melodic structure under their fingers and in their ears. I then give them material based on the piece to improvise on. So I'm giving them the standards, if you like, but they're my own standards. And one thing which, this is a funny thing to admit, but it's an oft-told story by me, but it's still a good one, and that is a guitar-playing friend of mine in New Zealand, who I'm still in contact with, was a wonderful improviser, and I asked him, how do you do it? This was years and years ago. And he said to me, I have two secrets. I'm going to now tell you what they are. And I said, what are they? And he said, major pentatonic and minor pentatonic. And what I discovered is that most of my music, when you try to improvise on it, is either major pentatonic or minor pentatonic. I hardly ever use any modes other than Dorian or Mixolydian.
Okay.
In other words, I don't use that many modes anyway. I'm not really a jazz writer in that sense.
Yep.
I'm much more of a sort of straight-ahead pop writer.
Well, and they're the modes and the scales that are probably most accessible too. They're the easiest to understand. And Daniel, in fact, talked about them in detail last time.
But, well, I've got a secret with what I do, which is a very, very easy thing to explain, but it's a very profound secret. And that is, when the student learns the piece, it has a melody, often which are quite easy. You know, they're good melodies, they're easy to remember.
Mm.
But when you analyse how many notes there are in the melody, often there aren't that many notes, and often there are five, sometimes there are only four notes. And what I do is then say to them, when you improvise on this piece, you use the same four notes or five notes that were in the original melody.
Yes.
And that isn't necessarily a whole scale. It might be the bottom four notes of a Dorian mode in theory, or it might be a pentatonic scale with an added note. You know,
right.
I mean, pentatonic minor, for instance, is D, F, if it's D, it's D, F, G, A, C.
Yes.
Yeah. But I often go D, E, F, G, A, C.
Okay.
In other words, I'm effectively using hybrid scales in my pieces. So therefore, when they improvise, they give them that hybrid scale. I don't see what the scale is. I like the idea of a row of notes.
Actually, it doesn't matter.
Which is the notes you've been playing.
Yes.
Because your hand's in the position anyway. And don't get hung up on theorising about something over the top of that.
Mm,
do you
sure.
understand the theory? Yeah. I mean, you see what I mean? It's a very simple idea, but it's a very profound one.
Yeah.
It's a bit like trying to do a classical improvisation on a Beethoven piece and saying the only notes we're going to use are the notes in the original melody.
Yeah.
In other words, you're not saying that you could theoretically use chromatic scales for this because you say, well, we're not going to because Beethoven doesn't use any chromatic scales.
Mm.
So I'm literally taking the material I have invented, melodically that is, and getting the student to use those notes. And the second thing I do, which is a very profound thing as well, is I start by giving them the rhythms.
Right, okay. So a cool rhythm, so you know it's automatically going to have...
It's not just a cool rhythm, in fact. I think one of the big things is that the rhythm I give them is a different rhythm from the original melody altogether.
Okay.
The idea that you can have a backing, either the piano coming into or the backing track, and you can actually come up with a completely different idea, which still sounds good, in a completely different rhythm.
Yep.
But the rhythm I give them has certain repetitive elements in it, because I'm emphasising the fact that when you improvise, you shouldn't just improvise with no repeats.
Continually.
In other words, you're trying to do something which has some kind of inbuilt structure.
And that's
so I'm
the
giving
idea.
Them a rhythmic structure.
Yeah.
Then I say to them, now that you've got the notes and the rhythm which I've supplied, now try inventing your own rhythms and using some of your own notes. In other words, add more notes, add different rhythms. And then I say, now don't take any notes what I've said, just do your
just
own
do
thing.
It.
But it's giving them a kind of jumping off point. I think that's a good way of putting it. I'm giving them jumping off points for improvisation.
Yep.
And you could even go further and say, now we've got to this, there is a theory about the use of the Dorian mode for this piece. Here's the theory, now try doing that.
Mm.
Or even say, now let's try using a Phrygian mode for this one and give them that and say, now that you've got used to the idea of doing your own thing, see how delicious this can be with a sharp fourth note.
Yeah.
So all the workshops I do, the children start off with absolutely everything given to them, and then gradually I say to them, now you add something. And the funny thing is, all the workshops I do, nearly everything that happens in groups, children start to add notes and rhythms without me telling them.
Ah, yes.
And I always say to them, aha, when somebody adds a note or a rhythm, and they love this, I say to them, this changes everything. Because now, and everybody in the group is very startled when I say, I've just heard somebody add, like a sharp six.
Is it going to be a bad thing or a good thing?
And I'm saying, you've just added that. That means everybody gets to use it.
Yeah.
And they love that. Yeah. And I think that the idea that they own their own new additional ideas is a very powerful one as well.
Mm.
So that's the kind of theory I'm operating on.
Yeah. Okay.
It sounds quite simple in principle, but in fact, as I said, it has a certain profundity about it when you try it out in practice. It's lovely.
Yeah. So, backtracking a second, I just want to make sure we've captured everything. I'll put some instructions. I might put actually a bit of a sheet about modes and these pentatonic scales, just a list and how they all work.
Yeah.
Because we've mentioned some Dorian and Mixolydians and things, and teachers might be going, I don't know what all that means. So I might just put a couple of notes about that. But in all honesty, what you're saying is that if you use the APP books, the American Popular Piano books, you don't need to know any of that stuff because once they've learned the piece, in the improvisation section, you give them the notes that they can use.
Yeah, and I give them notes which they've already been using.
Yes, that's right. The notes that originally made up the melody in the first place.
Yeah,
yeah. So I think we might just have a chat about this cheat sheet that Chris is very kindly sharing with everyone. And this I'll have a link to on our show notes. So the show notes for this will be timtopham.com/episode2. And this is Chris's 10 tips on teaching improvisation. And you've kind of just gone through them, a basic overview of them. But what we might do is just go through each of those steps just briefly again now so we know what's going on.
Sure.
And I'll just ask you questions in case I don't quite understand anything.
Yeah.
So the first step is learn the piece first. So what piece are they learning?
Well, that's their choice. And the thing is, AmericanPopularPiano.com has pictures of all the book covers. If you click on the book covers, you actually get an audio performance of every piece.
Okay.
So the students can actually hear the pieces. And what often happens is they decide which piece they'd like to learn or pieces they'd like to learn by hearing them.
Right, okay. And so, are they graded somehow?
Yes, they are. There's actually 8 levels.
Okay.
It's American levelling, so it's easier than Australian levelling.
It's very confusing.
Which is nice. It's the same levelling as Piano Adventures and Hal Leonard.
Okay, sure.
In fact, when I did this series, I looked at those books particularly and made sure that none of the things in them are any different. In other words, right. We introduce quavers at the same level, we introduce dotted notes at the same level, etc., and so on.
So it can be used alongside a method book?
Yes, it can.
Yeah.
Alongside an American method book, ideally, but just because of the leveling.
Yes.
But what's interesting about American popular piano is it goes up to level 8. No American series does that.
No.
So I'm on uncharted territory right. there, if you like. But APP has taken them on all 8. Well, actually, I say 8. There's actually 9 levels because it's a preparatory book, and then there's 8 levels. They've taken on a whole lot spread across their grades. And so if you look at the APP syllabus, I think, so let's try that again. If you look at the ANSCA syllabus and see where APP fits in, it's fairly clear to see where the pieces okay. sort of roughly fit
in. So I might put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah.
Because I've seen that document online. That would be quite helpful. Okay, so let's say we've got a student who's grade 1 level-ish in Australia.
Yeah.
Let's say that's, I don't know off the top of my head.
Let's say they open the book. Yeah, APP level 1.
Level 1, great.
I mean, I think it's quite good being the same level as though it's grade 1, because the improvisation is so different, if you like, that people who are doing grade 1 piano still find it quite nice not to be playing pieces which are too difficult.
Really difficult, absolutely.
So I think in a way it works okay to actually, if you're grade 1, go for level 1, if you're grade 2, go for level 2 and so
on. And we're all big fans in Australia of playing as many pieces as possible.
And it makes it possible
at a lesser level.
To play more pieces, yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And APP is an ideal thing because everything in the book is leveled the same. They're not graded through the book, so there's nothing progressive in the book.
Yep.
So you can open the book anywhere and it's all at the same level.
Okay.
I think that's quite a useful point to make. So they choose a piece, and for instance, level 1, they might choose a piece which I've used quite a bit called The Girl on the Beach.
Yes.
Which is a bossa nova, and it's one of the rhythmic pieces. It's only got 4 notes in it, which is nice, and it's a duet. So the teacher's got a nice little bossa nova accompaniment, and the student has got a right-hand melody which has got 4 notes altogether in it, and some left-hand chords. Now, this is an important point, all of which are inversions, because in fact, what I discovered with APP, as it's now being called, is that I've used chord inversions right from the beginning, right from the prep, all the way through. There's hardly ever a root position.
Okay, this is in the left hand.
In the left hand. Yeah. And it means that by the time you get to level 6, you've played chord inversions, including third inversion, seventh chords, even fourth inversion, ninth chords, without knowing what they are.
Right.
But you've got the feel of them, the sound of them. So by the time at level 6, we start to introduce the theory of the chord inversions, you think, oh yeah, I've already done that before.
Yeah, that was level, what level?
Level 6.
Level 6,
yeah, level 6 to 8, actually, the improvisation suddenly introduces theory of scales and chords and chord symbols and all that sort of thing.
Okay.
But up to then, it's all done with grand staff.
Right, okay.
So you learn the piece.
Yep, so that's step one. Learn the piece, choose a piece, and learn it.
And it's a nice little piece to play, and you've got the flavour of it, and you've also got the notes which you use. So that's point one.
And there's a teacher duet with some of them? All of them?
Well, the ones where there's improvisation, now this is a complicated thing to explain, and I apologise for this, but where there is improvisation, there is a backing track.
Right.
But there's a teacher accompaniment for the ones that were originally ensembles.
Okay, so there's 3 types in the book.
Yeah.
You've got the rhythmic pieces, which are solos.
Yes, they're solos. Lyrical pieces, which are solos.
And you've got teacher duets,
which have got a teacher accompaniment.
Okay, and do any of them have backing tracks?
Yeah, all the ensembles have backing tracks.
Okay, so these ones here, the last one. Yeah. So you can actually...
But what we liked was the idea is that the lyrical and rhythmic pieces, you're learning to play the piano as a solo pianist.
Yes.
So we didn't want to plaster it with the backing tracks.
Yes, no, that makes sense.
But when you improvise on it, I then add a backing track.
Yes,
I think that's the easiest way to explain it.
And so when you get to the improvising pieces, the duets at the end, you've got teacher duet, so the teacher can play along, and the backing track can be played
exactly.
along.
Exactly. So it's effectively a 3-part ensemble.
Exactly, yeah, which is great. All right, so we've learned the piece. Step 2.
Yeah.
Start with a beat.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is taking the backing track or the teacher accompaniment, although the backing track's the best thing, you ask the student to clap a beat. Now, there are some funny statistics on this, amusing, funny, and that is that when you take the average 8-year-old, quite a percentage of them can't clap a beat to a backing track.
Right.
They're just not quite used to the idea of separating the beat from the rhythm.
Yes, I find that.
You think that everybody could, but in fact, it's a bit of a concept. One thing I've discovered, though, I'm just going to have a sip of water.
No problem.
In order to put it down, and say that one of the hardest things to do, if you've got a backing track which goes dum, 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 let's say, to do that. to just clap, to clap, because it's a very percussive sound. So what I found is much better is to go.
Okay.
Or anything, and the kids love that. Immediately, in other words, making that, or more like a beatbox.
Yes,
hit
sure.
your chest for the first beat. Boom. Ah, ah, ah. If I do that with students, they much prefer it to going.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's a bit more fun, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'm suggesting straight away that you ask the student to do a beat, but don't ask them to do a difficult beat. A difficult beat is clapping.
Okay, yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I like tapping.
Even to the extent of tapping your leg or tapping your foot.
Yes.
But what you're trying to do is get used to the idea of them keeping steady, because what you don't want to do is have students improvising when they can't even keep a beat.
Yes.
In other words, because they're going to play out of time straight away, and I've discovered students who can't clap a beat can't play in time either. And therefore, you need to kind of train them a little bit. And most piano teaching, I think, is drilling in a good way. In other words, you get the students to clap a beat, and you get them to do it quite a few times, and they practice it all week. That's the first thing they do when they're trying to improvise, is they just take the backing track. And the second thing is not just to clap, but also to think about, to say to the students, here's what I mean by a beat. Now, what sort of beat feels natural to you? Because if I went boom, ch, dun, dun, ch, dun, dun, as a beat, I might go boom, ch, dun, dun, ch, dun, dun. And did you notice my foot was going in crotches and I was clapping minims?
Minims, yep.
Often students clap minims.
Right, they don't necessarily, that's the natural feel.
And therefore, to a bit, to a bar.
Yeah.
And as drummers will tell you, if you clap minims or you clap crotches, it's a different feeling. If you have off beats, it's different from going 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3.
Sure. Yeah.
That's already straight away a slightly more Latin beat.
Yes.
You know, just like that. Because you quite like that. So if you had a piece in that kind of rhythm, some students might even do that.
Yeah.
Some musical students, and clap the fourth beat.
Yeah.
And you say to them, that's great. They're still clapping a beat. It's the idea of ascertaining what the beat is,
sure,
if you like.
Sure, and feeling it and getting it in.
So you might say the second point, which we might make, says start with the beat, is feel the beat, isn't
sure,
it?
Sure, yeah. And this is along to the backing track, isn't it?
Yeah, although it could be done with the piano accompaniment, with the teacher accompaniment, if there's a teacher accompaniment as well. But the backing track is the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
Because they're getting used to hearing the backing track as well and doing something different against the backing track than the original tune. All the time it's that idea of hearing a backing and thinking, now I'm going to do something different to it.
Sure. Okay. So they've got a beat, they're tapping a steady beat along to the backing track.
Yeah.
Step three, clap a given rhythm.
Yeah.
So what's this rhythm? Where's that?
Well,
come
the rhythm
from?
The improvisation in the American popular piano books is in the second book. There's a book of repertoire, the Lyrical Rhythmic Ensemble, but the second book is called Etudes.
Okay.
It's level one etudes.
Now, etudes makes me think of Chopin.
That's right. And etudes means studies. It's improvisation studies.
Okay.
We apologise for the terminology, but it's become known as APP etudes. So that's what it was called.
Yeah.
But basically, the etudes has four modules for each piece, each etudes book, and they have the same format within the module. And the first thing you do after the beat is I give you a rhythm to clap to the backing track. It's a pretty simple rhythm. It's usually easier than the original rhythm was, but it is different from the original rhythm.
Okay. And at the low levels, it would be crotchets and minims.
It's just crotchets and minims. It's very straightforward, but in fact, when you hear the backing track with it, often it's quite sophisticated in effect. I mean, kids clap it and actually think, actually, that sounds great, even though... And the other thing I do, just as a tip, is if you had... Here's a rhythm, for instance, you went... So that's all crotchets, minutes, and one semibrieve.
Right.
But I say to them, if you've got a white note on your leg, if you've got a black note, clap.
Okay.
Yeah. And then reverse it. Then you think immediately it's making you more like a drummer.
Absolutely. And more connected.
Yeah. So I'm saying it's quite fun to make games out of the colours of the notes as well, and actually say, do white notes on your head. you know, black notes on your fingernails.
I can imagine my kids liking that.
Yeah. Have fingernail polish and do the black notes with the polish. You know.
Anyway. Okay, so they've got the rhythm. So they've chosen one of the modules in the etudes book, and they've clapped along to the backing track the actual rhythm that's written in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. All right. So then, step four, you say play the rhythm on one note.
Yeah.
That's going to sound very boring, isn't it?
It's going to sound quite good. Because, in fact, the one note, if it's in C major, it'd be C. You take the key note. Mm. And so the teacher has to make a quick decision as to whether the piece is major or minor and what the last note is like to be, and use that. Sometimes it's slightly ambiguous, but mostly it's fairly clear. So if it was in C major, you'd be playing it on middle C. And you tell them, play middle C with your thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And don't have the rest of your fingers off the keyboard.
Yes, okay.
So, okay, so just have a good hand position, but play it with thumb. The thing is, when the backing track's playing, if in the Girl on the Beach is a good example, it goes D minor, sort of G7, C major 7, F major 7. It's a kind of cycle of fourth, fifth thing. The C sounds different every bar because the chords underneath keep changing.
Ah, I see.
And so they're getting used to the idea of hearing the first chord and thinking, oh, that sounds quite nice. It's the seventh of a D minor seventh chord. But the next chord is probably a G7, and it's going to be a bit of a clash with it.
Right.
So they're already getting used to the idea that even one has a particular effect.
Sure, yeah. And it doesn't always have to be a note of the chord.
And
it
doesn't have to be
work.
A note of the chord to work. In fact, the note you're playing keeps having a different relationship with the bottom of the chord. But what I like about it is you're not saying what that relationship is. All you're doing is hearing it.
Yes, yeah.
It's a Gadai idea that you experience everything first and name it afterwards.
Mm. I was going to say, a lot of the tapping and things is a Gadai concept.
Yeah, I haven't looked closely at Gadai, but apparently I'm very similar.
Yeah, I think
APP
from my experience,
it's remarkably similar to the Gadai methodology, it seems.
Yeah.
And it does have the same kind of effect. Anyway, so you can see the reason for using one note.
Well, that just takes out all the complexity. First,
you get used to the idea of adding rhythm and pitch, because it's hard.
Right.
It's hard enough to clap a rhythm which is written against the backing track without then adding a whole lot of notes.
Sure.
So basically, you strip everything away except the one note.
Okay.
And make it the key note.
All right. So they've gone through and they've played the C or whatever note it is along to the backing track.
Yeah.
According to the rhythm that's in the piece.
Yeah.
All right. And then step five, it says create your own melodies.
Yes, in fact, there is an intermediate step which I do. I don't know if I've said this in the notes, but I should really say it.
No.
Rhythm on one note.
I'm guessing it's start on two notes or three notes.
Exactly. Now, what I tend to do is this. If you're, and this is the easy thing to say, again, profound in effect there. If you're in a major key piece, I start by using the notes of the major pentatonic scale.
Okay.
So C major, you go with C, and then C and D. And I don't mean C and D together. I mean C or D.
Yeah, so using that rhythm, just alternate.
Yeah, just saying, use C or D, you can start on the D or the C, you don't have to, you can play a whole lot of repeated Cs and then have a 1D.
Right.
But just try various combinations out with that rhythm with only two notes. And then once they've got that, even while they're still playing, I say, now can you add E? And so you go C, D, E, and then the next note isn't F, it's G.
Yes.
And the next note isn't G, it's A.
But all these notes are written in the etude?
No, they're not.
Okay.
No, because what happens in the etude is it jumps straight to a melody using all the notes of the original melody.
Okay.
If I'd done all those steps, I would have ended up a huge, huge book.
Yeah.
But what I've discovered is very good is the idea of stepping it bit by bit. So you introduce one note, then two notes, then three, then four, then five, quite quickly, and you end up with all the notes in the original piece, which are on the right-hand page in a little box. You can see them as a teacher. You can see at a glance how many notes you're heading for.
Right, okay.
And if it's a minor key piece, you tend to use the minor pentatonic.
Right.
Only, I tend to use the second degree of the scale. So A minor would be A, B, C, D, E, G.
Okay.
In other words, a minor pentatonic scale with an added second note.
Right.
Now, that sounds complicated, but again, once you've got it, you've got it.
Yeah.
And if it's a blues piece, you tend to use the blues scale.
Yeah.
So there's the three obvious things. That gets you into the swing of things of playing that rhythm using a variety of notes. Then you get to the book, go back to the book. Suddenly I give you a melody which is written in the book using all the notes of the original melody.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't even have to use them all, but it certainly uses most of them in that rhythm.
Right.
And that's
not the original melody.
It's another
variation.
Melody altogether.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, I don't always even do that step. Sometimes I don't even bother. I go straight into their own melodies.
Yes.
But which is what the notes say.
But
you can go to that step then. And then what you can do from level one on was add the left-hand chords. So you play just left-hand chords to the backing. And they're all inversions.
Okay.
And then, of course, the next step is you put your hands together.
Right.
And that's surprisingly hard.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And therefore, the book, although it looks straightforward, when you try it, you think, this is nothing like as easy as I expected, but neither is it as hard as I expected.
Yeah.
It's a kind of nice combination. But students, in a way, need to get really comfortable with all the elements before they start putting it all together too quickly. So you don't need to rush into it. You can say to them, we're going to do this for 5 minutes in the lesson along with other things you're doing, and then I'd like you to do a bit of that every day.
Yeah.
And I think they'll enjoy it.
So, it sounds like there's a lot of opportunity for variation in the books. Like, you can play the original, you can do simple improvisation, you can look at the tunes that you've improvised. You know, sounds like there's lots of different ways
I'm
to do it.
I'm trying to do it so that teachers end up feeling a bit more creative about the whole thing as well.
Yeah. But while giving them a grounding,
but
too.
Just going back to the individual notes, though, what I've discovered is that once if it's the C major and the students have played the note C, D, E, G, A, sometimes the student will play the note B, or even the note F sharp, or the E flat. In other words, they realise there are some blue notes which might sound quite nice. That's kind of what you're looking for. In other words, they start to hear notes that aren't in the scale, which still fit the backing.
Yeah.
And the same with the rhythm. The moment a student starts to depart from the rhythm, like does a little syncopation, you say, aha, why did you do that? And they say, because it felt right. And I say, well, okay, this changes everything.
Yeah.
Now we get to
we
do what, now we get to do your rhythm. Forget about mine. Mine was good, I will say that.
Yeah.
But yours is better.
So do you find that happens? That students, they kind of almost make a mistake. They would think.
Yeah. But in fact, sometimes
a mistake is what you want.
Sometimes a mistake is an instinctive move, because I'm a composer. Often what appear to be mistakes, I think it is your brain putting your fingers into a position for a good idea. So you're looking for mistakes to happen, in a sense.
Yeah. All right, so they've created their own melodies. They might have started with a couple of notes, built it up.
Yeah.
And then you say, step six, create a two-bar melody and then play it back. So this is about...
Now, this is
looking for licks, things that sound
looking
good.
Looking for licks. Now, this isn't just looking for things that sound good. It's looking for something you can actually remember.
Right.
Because often students play improvisations, so-called, but all they're doing is playing their fingers mechanically up and down, hoping for the best. If I say to them, what did you just play? And they can't even remember a two-bar melody. I'm saying, what I'd like you to do is do something so simple that you can remember to play it back. And if they can't do it, I say, I'd like you to play C, two, three, four, C, two. And I say, that's your melody. Now play it again. In other words, strip it right back to the simplest thing they can do and say, no matter what you do, it's going to sound good, but let's repeat it.
Okay.
Because they begin to believe in their own melody and they begin to believe in their own ideas if they can repeat it.
I find students, if they are improvising, even on a simple blues scale, for example, which I like doing in lessons, that they'll come up with something that sounds really cool and I'll go, wow, that was great. Do more of that or do that again.
And they look at you quizzically and say, no, I can't, I don't know what I did.
Or they somehow might have not even heard that it was actually any good. So, it's about kind of switching them on and getting
them used
to...
Switching them on to transcribing yourself. That's what it is.
Yeah, so I think that's a really, really good thing. Because ultimately, I'm by no means a jazz musician, but I know things, if I'm asked to improvise, that sound cool.
Yeah.
And I've just got that in my repertoire and I know to do it. So it's about helping students learn to listen and be able to repeat things that they know sound good.
And students are always startled if they're playing something and they play a nice little idea, and I play it straight back to them. And they say, oh, they weren't expecting anybody to actually believe in their idea enough to play it back to them.
Yeah.
So it's trying to encourage them to play back their own idea.
All right, and then step seven, play the same two-bar melody and repeat it with one note changed.
Yes.
Why do you get them to do that?
The idea of doing not just a repeat, but actually doing a slight variation.
Okay.
So if it's a doom, 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 to go ding 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 dong.
Right.
Simple as that. So you play the same melody twice, but you change the last note, say, or you change one of the notes. They can immediately tell the little twists of melody changes, which actually is part of the appeal of music, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
And my trick as a composer, a lot of the time, I think, is I repeat things, but I don't repeat them exactly the same. I do slight variations, just trying to keep people from guessing. I heard recently from somebody who said that when you're doing a jazz solo, that too much repetition is boring for the listener, too much variation is alienating.
Right, that's a good way to put it.
In other words, audiences want to hear a certain amount of repetition within the solo, but they also want to hear a certain amount of variation.
There's a fine balance, isn't it?
That balance between repetition and variation.
Yeah.
So in other words, it wouldn't work particularly to have a solo which you only repeated the phrases exactly the same.
Yes, yeah.
So getting used to the idea of that subtle variation, which jazz players almost automatically do, they play a little lick back, but they'll play it back with a slight variation.
Okay, good. So we're getting to the close to the finish. Step eight, you say, work through the APP modules for the piece.
Yeah.
So they've gone and they've effectively improvised their own tune to one of the backings.
Yeah.
Why do they go back and then learn
because they're
these
ones? Because they're adding the left-hand chords.
Ah, okay.
In particular. One of the things about the left-hand chords as well in APP is that every module, the left-hand rhythms are different. It's the idea of getting used to the idea of having chord positions for the left hand, which are quite easy to play, but you don't play the same rhythm all the time.
Mm.
In other words, you have continual variation of the left-hand rhythms as well.
Okay.
But that's the hardest thing to do. And often when I'm doing group improvisation, I don't get round to both hands together at all. I just don't have time. But if they do it, they can see there's a lot of pleasure from the combination of the sound of it. Because once you've got inverted chords and these nice pentatonic or mixolydian melodies or whatever, you're starting to sound like the real thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's great just to like get that out of root position too, isn't it, in the left hand?
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, and then you've suggested start to use grace notes, pedal notes, tremolo chords, etc. So it's about just adding those little touches.
Adding those coloration things, because when I do that, students always look, I say to them, would you like to do that when I do something like a tremolo or a grace note? And they say, yes, we want to do that.
Mm. And so like kind of sliding off a note.
Yeah, because it's making them sound more like guitar players.
Yes.
Because you know, jazz pianists, if you ever talk to a very good jazz player, say, where do you get your ideas? They often say horn players or guitarists.
All right.
In other words, because they can all play the same thing as each other, including the effect of bending.
Yeah.
Or pedal notes, of course, is where you have open strings on a guitar or a violin sounding above or below the melody.
Mm.
And that's a very effective thing on the piano as well.
Mm. Absolutely.
So, yes.
So, would you demonstrate?
I do.
Demonstrate.
Just colouring it up.
Yeah. Great. And then the last step, step 10, try some free improvisation.
Yeah.
Improvisation.
Now, I do this quite a bit where there are some pieces which are a bit more sort of atmospheric and ethereal, and I get them having like a repeated left-hand figure.
Mm.
Might be, there's one, I'm just thinking aloud, of a piece, it's a piece called Seabird in the Connection series, for instance, where you have, it's a mixolydian piece, so you have D A in the left-hand followed by C, G. In other words, it's in D minor of sorts, but always has a flat seventh. And just going boom, 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 boom. So a bit like a Debussy piece.
Mm.
And then give them a little scale and say, now let's just try something where you just keep playing as long as you can.
Right, okay, over the top.
Just and they love doing that, students. And the idea of having something which is much freer as well. So I like to mix it. And the books do actually do the same thing.
Right, okay. Wow. A lot of information.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I remember the last time we actually caught up in person was, would have been 4 years ago, I think. And Chris presented this exact series at the conference. That was
And the interesting APPC. Thing was I had a couple of little girls who were not improvisers.
Not at all, no.
And they did it in spite of themselves. They almost looked startled at their own efforts, didn't they? It was quite telling.
Absolutely. and the teachers, I know, were all, they loved the idea that they could get kids improvising using something that's written down, because it's it's a bit of a safe way to start.
Which is why I'm very pleased that ANSCA is the first Australian board which has taken up this APP for improvisation. So that's why I'm here, is really to actually just hold the hands of teachers further and say, look, it is very easy to understand the principles of it. Let's just have a go, and you'll suddenly realise that it's a liberating kind of thing to do, and it can be added into your teaching program. It doesn't have to become your teaching program.
Sure,
it's just a very nice little adjunct, if you like. But the funny thing is, and this is my final point, perhaps, is that I've discovered that if students get to do their own thing, it's getting them along the line of playing the piano for the rest of their lives.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, because I feel as though if students improvise and find their own voices, that's much more likely to make them play forever more than to play a whole lot of pieces from books, if you like. Because self-expression, in a way, in the end of the day, everybody likes the idea of sitting down at the piano. I was very struck by this. This is not just self-expression as well, because I do a lot of work in schools. And I was at a school the other day, and the teacher turned to me quite casually and said, it's so-and-so's birthday. Can you play Happy Birthday? And I said, sure. Whereas a lot of people think, no.
Or I don't know how that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is I think learning to play APP, you're not just learning to improvise and have self-expression. You're kind of learning to get your way around chord progressions. It's got a lot of standard chord progressions in it as well.
Mm.
So it's giving you a vast repertoire of standard chord progressions without you realizing as well, which means if you did have to improvise something or even play just the tune of Happy Birthday, you're in with a chance, instead of no chance at all.
Right,
yeah.
which is great. You know, those kind of skills are so important. And I think I've joked in blog posts before about how I wouldn't be surprised if I could go to a conservatory and ask a top-level piano student to improvise something, play Happy Birthday with some chords, and they might not be able to.
Yeah, you know, that's right.
I think it's really fundamental to understand that chord structure and be able to make things up. It's what I enjoy.
And doing. I think, in fact, if you go right through to the end of the course, 6, 7, and 8, you've ended up with a whole lot of information about chord symbols and chord inversions and chord functions as well.
Which is,
and in other words, I do describe the course as chords 1, 4, 5, etc. But what's quite funny about what I do as well, there's a standing joke I've got, which I say at others' podcasts, I can't use it very much live anymore, but it is true. Somebody once said to me, why haven't you got chord symbols on the micro jazz books?
Right.
And I said, I don't want people to find out how few chords I use. But in fact, a lot of the time I am using quite a small number of chords, but when you actually try and improvise on them, like I get a jazz player to play riff around on some of my pieces, I discover the actual implied chords are not very complex, but they're quite sophisticated.
Sure.
And when I've tried to actually analyse the chord, somebody said to me, you know, could you give me a chord analysis of Dreaming? Do you know Dreaming from the Micro Jazz collection? It's been a very popular examination piece. But anyway, I thought about it. I thought it was C major 7 and D over G, C over F, E flat major 9, D minor 7 sus. In other words, the chords in it were like ruthlessly jazz chords.
Yeah.
But I hadn't written any of them down. And kids love that piece, but they wouldn't be interested up to about the age of 14 in knowing what any of those chords were called. They just like the sound of it.
That's it.
But beyond a certain point, they suddenly think, I wonder what that is. And the reason they want to know, perhaps, is because they like to be able to use that information to play their own chords on, or you know, in another key or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I'm saying this is a path to musicianship.
Sure. Yeah.
Not just a path to improvising on my pieces, but actually a path to general musicianship.
And I love that idea of anything that can help students understand chord inversions, particularly. You know, that it's a challenging thing to understand.
It's a very hard thing to explain. Yeah.
It is.
And I love the idea of a whole course which is all based on chord inversions, which is what APP is.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. So, and look, I'll put, obviously, Chris's cheat sheet will go in the show notes. Thank you very much for that. It's a great reference. I'll also put links to the APP books so people can see them and some screenshots and that sort of thing. And I'll also link to ANSCA. And I was just going to ask you, I'm assuming you know, do the pieces from the APP, are they actually, they're examinable kind of pieces in the modern pianoforte course?
Yes, they are. Right? Yeah.
Great.
That's my understanding, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And with backing tracks or not sure?
Well, only if the backing tracks are available.
That's fantastic. So we better just quickly sum up your upcoming workshops.
Yes.
So you're in Melbourne this weekend?
I'm in Brisbane this weekend.
Okay.
Doing a day on Saturday.
Okay.
And then I'm coming into Sydney on Monday and doing some work with the King's School in Sydney because my wife and I have written a musical, an Anzac musical for the King's School, which has been premiered in October. It's the first one we've done a commission type for Australia, but we've written 26 musicals altogether.
These are the micro musicals, aren't they?
Which is becoming quite a thing.
So I'll put it. Have you got a website or is there?
Yeah, micro musicals is a sort of spur off my website off christopherwhitten.com.
Okay. So I'll put a link to that in case you guys work in schools and
you're interested in those. These are musicals which are written for under 12s.
Okay.
So it's quite useful, and they don't ever last more than half an hour, and they can be learned in as little as 2 days.
Sounds great.
Yeah, so they're quite fun. And then I'm coming into Melbourne and doing some an ANSCA workshop in Melbourne and some private lessons.
Okay.
And then Canberra.
Right. Canberra, that's mid-April, I think, or
that's
8 to 10
April-ish. The following week. And then I'm across to New Zealand to go to Auckland, Tauranga, Dunedin.
Okay. And that's April 12 to 16 for the Kiwis.
And then fly to Hong Kong and do some workshops there, and then I'm home again.
Guinness.
Back into work in London.
Busy man. Well, Chris, thank you so much for all that.
Great.
It's really, really good to spend some time with you. And I'm very keen, I think down the track we talked about maybe just doing a bit of a chat about you and what you do these days. I think people would find it really, really interesting. But that's the subject of a future interview, I think.
Yeah.
But yes, thank you very much for your time. Great. Lovely to speak with you.
Likewise.
And guys, if you're interested in any of those show notes, they'll all be at timtopham.com/episode2. All the downloads, links, and everything that we've talked about will be there. So thank you. Until next time, see you later.